And welcome back. Robert Sullivan IV with us. We're talking about his latest work, Cinema Symbolism 2. Got a few more movies to talk with him about, then we'll get to your calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Oh, welcome back. Robert Sullivan IV with us, Cinema Symbolism 2. Robert, let's talk about a few more movies, and then we'll come to calls. You touched on Kubrick a little bit with The Shining. Tell us what's in that one.
Yeah, great study. Repetition. The movie on its surface, of course, is about reincarnation. This guy, Jack Torrance, is he a reincarnation of, these two other characters or one of them? It's never fully explained. But the whole thing has to do with this vicious reincarnation murder cycle going on that seems to endlessly repeat itself going on inside the Overlook Hotel. On its surface, that's what it's about. To convey this to your subconscious mind, Kubrick repeats numbers and doubles. He just bombards you with it over and over again. And he does it so much, it's almost mind-blowing. I'll just get on this quickly. We won't have time to get into it because it's too long a narrative. But there is an astral, solar allegory, alchemical storyline going on inside that movie. But just getting back to the repetition, like, so for example, the movie ends where it begins. The movie begins with Jack driving on the road. The road that he's driving on is called the Going to the Sun Road, which was built in 1921. The number 21 he repeats at the end with the photos. There is 21 photos on the wall. It's three rows of seven. You take the number 21 and you double it, and you get the number 42. And this is another number he likes to hit your mind with. The movie that Shelley Duvall and Danny are watching in the hotel is The Summer of 42. Danny's shirt at the beginning of it, when he's talking to Tony in the mirror, has the number 42 on it. Huh. Scatman Crothers' license plate has the number 42 on it. If you take the phrase, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, that contains 33 letters and 9 spaces, add that together to get the number 42. If you take the room number 237 and multiply it, you get the number 42. Another number that he destroys your mind with is the number 12. He likes to hit your mind with this number. For example, if you take the number room number again, 237, and add it, you get the number 12. Scatman Crothers, when he is talking to them in the pantry, there's 12 pound bags of sugar, 12 jugs of black molasses, 12 turkeys, 24 pork roasts, 12 times 2. The hotel is KDK12. There are two times flashed on the screen, 8 and 4. Add 8 plus 4 to get the number 12. Jack Torrance throws the tennis ball against the wall 12 times. He hits the door with the axe 12 times. Danny and Wendy take 12 turns in the hedge maze. It's incredible just the level this man went to bombard your mind with this repetition and these repeating numbers. Doubles also he likes to play around with. There are two twin, the twin girls are doubles. Then when they're introduced in the Overlook and Allman is showing them the room, two older twin girls walk by, and you'll hear him say, have a nice summer, have a nice winter, ladies, or see you next summer, ladies. They're twin girls there. They're in Jack Torrance's wallet. There are two 10s and two 20s, doubles. Portland, Maine.
It's amazing how they do this, huh?
Yeah, there's two Portlands. Portland, Maine and Portland, Oregon are mentioned.
Now the average person though, Robert, would go right over their head, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You will not, your subconscious mind may pick up on some of this stuff, but no, this will go right by you. This is again, one of my motivations in writing both these books is to point this out. And The Shining is just such a great study in this. I mean, there's other themes going on inside this. I mean, you have this whole idea of, I'm just getting into some of this. You have the whole idea of the Overlook Hotel being sort of the dark side of America, the opulent dark side. It's being built on the Indian burial ground, symbolically burying the American Indians. You have the weapons of choice of of Jack and Wendy. It's the Indian tomahawk, the axe, versus the American pastime, the baseball bat. So you have this entire interplay going on of Native American culture versus American opulent society. And again, it's played out with the struggle going on with Jack Torrance. It will go completely by you if a lot of this, if you're not paying attention to it. Believe me, The Shining is a movie that, I mean, I've watched. I mean, I probably could watch it again and start seeing new stuff. You know, you watch this movie over and over again, you may not even pick up on it. But again, this is key to the research in this, and key to the books. And this is what I'm always stressing, is it's the context of how what's being presented in the movie. So, like, take The Shining, for instance. You have reincarnation, repetition. So that's what he's going for. He's repeating the stuff over and over again. Now you take another movie that doesn't have repetition in it, like Eyes Wide Shut. Well, he doesn't go down that alley. He goes down another alley. He uses the Christmas lights. He uses, you know, the color red, the occult symbols. So that's what makes Kubrick just so fascinating and so and such a great example of this. He knows, and genius. He knows when to use, you know, repetition and when to pull away from it and use something else. I mean, that's real craftsmanship, in my opinion.
We're going to come back to some movies, but let's take a few calls here while we can. Let's go to Phil in Ohio on the Wild Card line. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the program.
How you doing, George?
Great.
How you doing, Brother Sullivan?
Oh, welcome. Welcome to the show.
I just wanted to just call in and talk to Brother Sullivan for a second. I understand how Freemasonry works. I'm a two-time past forceful master of our Blue Lodge.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's Aurora 48 out of Portsmouth, Ohio, and I'm also a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason and a Knights Templar York Rite Freemason.
Well, that's wonderful. Congratulations. I'm here in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm in Amicable St. John's Lodge number 25, and I am a 32nd degree also Valley of Baltimore, Orient of Maryland. It's wonderful that you called in tonight.
Awesome. I'm Valley of Columbus, or Valley of Cincinnati, Ohio. Sorry. I'm a dual member of two, but I just want to talk about, you talk about the symbology and stuff, and Freemasonry gets such a bad rap, and, you know, there's so much secret to it, and everyone thinks there's all this lore about it, and really, the whole basis of Freemasonry is to take a good man and make him better. All the other stuff, I mean, is really, I don't want to say not essential. There's so many good teachings. You know, I've stood up and give so many lectures, and you know, we have we have inspections, and I stand up and give all the charges. And you know, I was, you know, as a worshipful master, you have to do that. But I just find it very interesting about the work you're doing and about how Freemasonry has got a bad rap. There was a movie called From Hell in 2003 with Johnny Depp. Are you familiar with that movie?
Yes, I am. I actually talk about it in Cinema Symbolism too.
Yes. I'm going to have to get your books, because the whole thing is, you know, if you looked in that movie, he was going through the rituals. He was going through the certain steps of each degree, each of the penalties, and so forth. And I just, you know, there's all the secrets of Freemasonry is really out there for people to learn. But what they don't understand is the true symbology of Freemasonry is brotherhood. That's what it's all about.
I agree with you. I totally agree. I've been involved with Freemasonry now for 20 years. I've found it nothing to be a positive experience, and I think for me personally, going through the Masonic rituals and the teachings and the symbology and the symbolism, my three books wouldn't exist but for Freemasonry. It certainly inspired me to write my books, and I view it as very positive. And, you know, when I was writing Royal Arch of Enoch, I talked about, you know, a part of my motivation was kind of to dispel some of the negative. I mean, a lot of times when you get into sacred architecture and these alignments, I mean, there was always this sort of default that, oh, this is negative, this is evil, and, you know, it's, you know, no good. I mean, I always found it to be, you know, if you get into it and you research it, I mean, it was very divinely inspired. And I totally agree with what you're saying. From Hell, just to pivot real quick. Yeah, it's a movie that it presents Masonry very negatively. I have a chapter in Cinema Symbolism 2 called Freemasonry in Popular Culture. I have another chapter on Alan Moore, on some of his stuff. Moore, I could have put the From Hell movie in the Masonic chapter. I put it in the Alan Moore chapter. Just a really quick on it, From Hell is about alchemy. That movie is where the Ripper character is using it's he's confusing murder with the Masonic rituals, with the Masonic penalties, to create what's called chaos magic and negatively affect the 21st century. That's sort of the underpinning of From Hell.
Now, you're a 32-degree Mason. What's a 33? I hear a lot about that.
Right, right. The Scottish Rite is degrees 4 through 32. That if you can't join the Scottish Rite until you're a Blue Lodge Freemason, that's degrees 1, 2, and 3. Once you're a Blue Lodge Mason, you're a Freemason, you can join the Scottish Rite, and that's degrees 4 through 32. The 32nd degree is as far as you can go. That's where it ends. You can't go any further. The 33rd degree is an honorary degree that you cannot solicit. You have to be invited to join it, or it has to be bestowed upon you. Generally speaking, it's reserved, and again, I'm painting with broad strokes here, it's reserved for people who have done a lot of charity work, a lot of, you know, maybe a politician, a celebrity in the area, a philanthropist. That's usually, and again, I'm painting with broad strokes, that's usually who the 33rd is bestowed upon.
Tell me about The Lion King. What's hidden there?
Ah, great one. Walt Disney. Walt Disney is often thought to be a Freemason, but he was not. There's a lot out there on Walt Disney that he was a Freemason and in the Illuminati. Walt Disney was not a Freemason. He was in a group called DeMole, which is the Masonic Boy Scouts. Certainly had an influence on him, but not necessarily a Freemason. But anyway, well, Lion King, yeah, great film. A lot going on in that. The Lion King takes place in Africa. We are dealing with the whole motif with this is the Egyptian Osirian cycle. The god, the sun god Osiris, this would be in the film, this would be his equivalent would be Mustafa. He is betrayed by the Osiris figure in mythology, is betrayed by his brother Osiris. This, of course, would be Scar. He is killed, and then, of course, his solar heir takes over. This would be Simba. And this would be the horse equivalent in The Lion King. Lots of solar Egyptian iconography in that film. For instance, it takes place in Africa, so immediately we are drawn to Egypt. We are dealing with lions, so of course that conjures in your subconscious mind the soul house of the sun, Leo the lion. That's, you know, The Lion King. When the lions are presiding in the pride lands of Africa, everything is glorious. Everything is wonderful. You will, if you are familiar with the sun and the earth's rotation around it, and this ties in, the brother who was just on the phone will know exactly what I'm about to say, is that the sun has three stations. That is the rising sun in the east, the sun at midday, which is the sun in the south, and the setting sun in the west. What is the one station that the sun never goes in? It's in the north. You will never find the sun in the north. Hence, in The Lion King, what is the one place that the lions cannot go into? It's the elephant burial ground. That's the place of darkness. That's the place of evil. Where is that located? In the north. Great solar allegory. Then, of course, you have the death of Mustafa, betrayal, and this is, of course, when Scar or Osiris take, or excuse me, or Set or Typhon takes over. So, of course, the pride lands. The sun is gone. The pride lands turn into a desolate wasteland until Simba comes back and reclaims the throne, defeats Typhon or Set, and takes his place as the solar heir of Osiris. So lots of solar Egyptian mythology going on in The Lion King. Just to wrap up, you are also dealing with some references to the Shakespeare play Hamlet, where clearly the Scar figure is the evil Uncle Claudius, and the Simba character is sort of avenging the father's death. The two characters of Pumbaa and Timba would be the Horatio character in Hamlet. I'll wrap up on that. I get into a lot more in the book, so check it out. But yeah, a combination of the Osirian mythology and Hamlet going on in The Lion King. Second highest grossing movie in 1994. Is it any surprise?
Let's go to Carrie in Roanoke, Virginia, first time caller. Hi, Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to ask him what he thought about the symbolism of Starship Troopers.
It is a movie that I have not seen in some time. I've seen the movie, but I've not watched it in at least 10 to 15 years, and in not watching it in that long a period of time, I wouldn't want to comment on the symbolism in Starship Troopers. I have seen it, but it's been so long since I've seen it, I would have to go back and take a look at it with a fresh pair of eyes.
So many other movies coming out, Robert, that are bringing new symbolism out there?
Well, I sure hope so. I got Cinema Symbolism 1 and 2 out. I've already started outlining Cinema Symbolism 3. I get asked about movies. This is no surprise what just happened, a movie that I haven't seen in a while or movies that I haven't seen at all. They're still doing it. For instance, let me think for a second.
And this book is almost 600 pages.
Yeah, it's like Cinema Symbolism Part 1 was, I think, 460, and this one was 668. So, yeah, I threw everything in but the kitchen sink. They just did it wasn't in the theaters. It was a TV show. I really enjoyed it. It just wrapped up. It was called Bates Motel. It was on A&E.
Oh, yeah, I heard
about
that.
And if you saw the last season of it...
It's based on the Psycho movie, isn't it?
Yes, correct. And if you are familiar with Norman Bates and Psycho, you will know that he is based on a real-life serial killer named Ed Gein. Yeah, he lived in Plainview, Wisconsin.
Isn't he the one Silence of the Lambs was created about? This is the guy who cut the skin off people and wore it, right?
That's absolutely correct. He is the basis for, Ed Gein is the basis for Buffalo Bill in
Silence of the Lambs. That's right.
And he is also the basis of Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw. If you watch Bates Motel in the beginning of season 5, Norman Bates is playing a record, and the record label is Plainview Records, which is, of course, a reference to Plainview, Wisconsin, which is the birthplace of Ed Gein. Very adroitly concealed reference to Ed Gein, the basis of Norman Bates.
Yeah, Ed Gein was truly whacked out, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, my goodness gracious. Ed Gein is the template for Bates. He's the template for, like you said, Buffalo Bill and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He was, what did he do? He dug up graves. He brought the bodies back. He had his mother, I think, preserved in an upstairs bedroom. He was a cannibal. He would skin the dead bodies off of corpses and dress up in the dead skin. Yeah, very, very gruesome.
Whacked out guy.
Yeah.
J.D. in Indianapolis, Indiana. Go ahead, J.D.
Hey, Mr. George, Mr. Robert, man, this show's like psychedelic, I'll tell you what.
You got it.
Oh, Mark, I got two things here. I was wondering about the movie Being There, originally released as Chauncey the Gardener with Peter Sellers and Shirley MacLaine. What kind of symbolism might be in there? And then my second question, I'm wondering, why do we even have symbolism to begin with? And I'll take...
All right, you got it. Let's do the second one first. Why symbolism?
Yeah, it's important because you can convey a lot of messages with it. You can convey a secret language with it. If you become symbol literate, you can decode and see things completely different. So I think it's a very important study. You get into, just real quick, like what we were talking about in the first hour, and this ties back into, even my first book, you get into things like Washington, D.C., or the templates, the streetscapes. I mean, there's reasons why the chief executive, the White House, where the chief executive lives, and the legislature, the Senate and the House of Republicans, the two elected branches of government, are connected by Pennsylvania Avenue. There's a reason for that. Pennsylvania Avenue is part of the hypotenuse forming the federal triangle, and of course, Pennsylvania is the keystone state. And what's a keystone? Well, it makes a royal arch, and this ties into esoteric Freemasonry, the royal arch degree. So when you decode the symbolism, you will see a whole new world will open up to you as to why things, why the state seal of California has a little guy on it digging downward to a subterranean.
Hold on, Robert. We're going to come back and take final calls and also his other question of the movie Being There, which came out in 1979, starring Peter Sellers. Let's get your take on that, too. And if you want to write the senator and congressperson with regards to the power grid, Greg, right after the show, in the show recap that we post online, we'll have their addresses that you can send a letter that you support the SHIELD Act, if you remember that. Back with Cinema Symbolism 2 and our special guest, Robert Sullivan IV. Robert, the other call was about Being There, a 1979 movie with Peter Sellers that had somewhat of a Illuminati twist to it. I don't know if you've seen that movie.
Yeah, no, I actually talk about it in the first book I wrote, The Royal Arch.
All right, good.
Book. Yeah, no, I just, I know we're somewhat getting a little low on time, but it's, Yeah, it's you have the Chauncey Gardner character, Peter Sellers, sort of representing the sun. He's always talking about the solstices and the equinoxes and growing and dying and the plant life. But then clearly at the end of this, I mean, that's I think what the caller was more asking about was you have the Rand character being placed in sort of, you know, being his coffin. The pallbearers are talking about selecting the president. They're clearly in some sort of Bilderberg, Illuminati-type group that Rand was in. And, of course, they put him in the tomb, which is, the Great Seal of the United States. It's the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top of it. So it has that conspiratorial twist to it at the end. It's a great movie. I think being there is fantastic. If you've never seen it, if you're listening and you've never watched it, by all means, give it a shot. But it's a great movie, and it's one that I touched on in my first book, The Royal Arch of Enoch.
All right, let's talk about a couple more movies, and we'll take some more calls. Tell us about the occult casting in films with Max von Sydow.
Oh, right. This was something I mentioned in the first hour, and I'll just try to get into this as fast as I can. This is where the symbol in the movie is the actual actor. And this is not typecasting. This is where they're bringing their performances from earlier works and investing the newer movie with it. At first, I thought this was sort of a rare instance. I'm beginning to see this a little more and more. Just real quickly, I'm not going to get into it, but I talked about this originally in my first book, Cinema Symbolism, my first movie book. Anthony Zerbe in the second Matrix movie, in the Matrix Reloaded, was used for occult purposes. His performance in that movie ties back to an earlier movie he made called The Omega Man. Max von Sydow in the Star Wars movie, this was Star Wars, the last one, not Rogue One, but Episode 7, the movie opens where he's this hermit figure, he's on the desert planet, and he gives the other guy the little chip or the piece of the map that'll lead to Luke Skywalker, and then the First Order arrives, they descend on the planet, and Kylo Ren comes out and essentially slashes him down. I have the movie here on Blu-ray, I've watched it a dozen times, and as I was watching, This just stood out to me. I kept thinking to myself, why is von Sydow in this movie? They could have gotten any actor under the sun to do this. He's only in it for the first couple minutes. It's very minor. And why do this? And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm just sitting there watching it, and I'm thinking to myself, what other movie have I seen at the very beginning of it, Max von Sydow play a hermit character in the desert, confront the Dark Lord? And it's The Exorcist. The movie is sort of conjuring.
He's a priest, isn't he?
Right. He plays the Jesuit priest in The Exorcist, and he confronts the demon, the statue of the demon in the desert. And this is exactly what is sort of going on at the beginning of the Star Wars movie. Von Sydow is the hermit character. He's living by himself, and he confronts the dark evil Lord Kylo Ren at the beginning of the movie in the desert. So why do this? What that is doing, what that imagery and that scenery is doing, and that casting by placing Von Sydow there, it's investing the First Order with sort of the evil and the demonism of Pazuzu from The Exorcist. It's letting you know, hey, these guys are really evil, they're no good. But it even goes further than that, because I started thinking about this, and I thought, I've seen this again somewhere else. And it actually ties into another movie that von Sydow played a hermit character in, and he's on the desert planet, and he confronts the dark evil lord, and it's Dune, where von Sydow is the hermit figure, he's the expert with the bodysuit, and he confronts the Harkonnen. Baron Harkonnen, the dark evil figure on the desert planet of Arrakis. And again, it's doing the same thing. It's transforming the First Order and Kylo Ren into sort of this barbaric evil character. And they're doing that simply by casting von Sydow. It's a great technique. You'll find it with Anthony Zerbe in the Matrix movie. His performance in that movie ties directly in to a movie he made called the Omega Man. And I'll just wrap up on this. I won't give it away. People can read the book. David Lynch does this exact same trick with Lost Highway, the casting of Bill Pullman and Robert Loggia in that movie ties into another movie that is uniquely related to it, I'll say. So, yeah, the actual casting of an actor or an actress can convey an occult message, and what they do, it's fascinating. They're bringing with them these what I call cultural valences and investing this new movie, and it's really a form of sorcery. By doing that with von Sydow, it's subconsciously conjuring The Exorcist and Dune. It's fantastic.
All right, Wayne in Tacoma, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Wayne, go ahead.
Good morning, Sir George.
Hi there.
And Robert. Hey, I was thinking about a gentleman, and that's being very kind, calling him a gentleman. He's probably the equivalent to Madame Blavatsky, who has his official offices in the United Nations building. And it's his job to introduce the ambassadors of the world to the unseen spiritual powers of the world. Now, George knows who I'm talking about. You can probably pull the name out of the hat. I can't think of his name offhand, but he's one of the few people that George kind of cut short on one of his programs because there was a lot of negative, super negative energy coming from this guy. In fact, he used to work for Lucas Trust before he had these offices, and he's been in the United Nations building for close to 50 years. Before Lucas Trust, it was called Lucifer Publishing Company.
Was that Benjamin Krem?
Yes, Benjamin Krem.
Yeah, he's dead now, I think.
Yeah, is he? Okay. Anyway, well, he's earned his just reward. There's two books that really I think your audience would get great benefit from. The first one is Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow by a lady lawyer out of Chicago called Constance Cumby. And she wrote all about these different organizations. And the second book is Can a Christian Be a Mason? And that clarifies where Masonry is. And I'll just leave that question about the Krem up to the gentleman, Robert.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to do some research. I'm not familiar with this person in any way, shape, or form, and I would have to look into it. I wouldn't even comment on it. I've never heard of this person.
Benjamin Krem was a guest of mine who apparently represented somebody called the Maitreya that some people believed might have been the Antichrist.
That's news to me. I don't know this character.
And when he was on, Robert, people got sick listening to him physically. It was
really
weird. So when I ended the interview early, those same people got even better, myself included, by the way.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, I sounds like a very weird character. I don't know him.
Let's go to Deborah in New Jersey, east of the Rockies. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Robert.
Hey.
My question is, before you spoke about the number 88 and you didn't finish your thought on that, and my question is about the movie Rosemary's Baby. Now, the character, one of the characters is Roman, and Roman Polanski, I think, directed it. Is there any coincidence in that and any other symbolism in that movie?
Yes, there is. It's a good question. Rosemary's Baby, the Roman cast of it character is his real name is Mercado, and that is actually a reference to a movie and a book called The Devil Rides Out, and in that book there is a black magician in it named Mercado, of all things. The book the book was written by a man named Dennis Wheatley, who was in the same espionage circles as Ian Fleming and Roald Dahl, who wrote Charlie Chocolate and Willie and the Chocolate Factory. Whatever it was, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Willy Wonka.
Yeah, Willy Wonka. The character of Mercado in Rosemary's Baby is a direct reference to Mercada in The Devil Rides Out, and the character in The Devil Rides Out is an analog for Aleister Crowley. So you have a Aleister Crowley tie-in with the Rosemary's Baby. The number 88, I'll try to get into this. This is a deep study. In The Exorcist, she's using it. Boy, oh boy, we're getting low on time. I'm going to try to do this as fast as I can. In The Exorcist, it's a reference to Jesus Christ. In Greek gematria, the number 888 is Jesus Christ. And she says to the doctors, there's blankety-blank doctors here in your hospital. There's 88 doctors here, and none of them can help me. That's a reference to Jesus Christ. If you pay attention to that scene, that is also esoteric imagery. The scene where Chris McNeil in The Exorcist is sitting with the doctors. That is a recreation of the Last Supper painting by Da Vinci. She is at the head of the table, surrounded by the four groups of three. And this is where they're telling her that a spiritual cure is needed for the daughter. So, of course, Friedkin puts the Last Supper up there. Great imagery. In the Back to the Future movie, the number 88 is important, but it's conveyed differently. you this will be drummed into your head ad nauseum over and over again in Back to the Future, that the time machine activates at 88 miles an hour. If you take the number 8 and turn it on its side, it's the number for infinity, manipulation of time. But is there a deeper meaning? Yes. We're told that the clock tower, and this is really drilled into your head, that the clock tower is going to get struck by lightning at 10:04 on the night of whatever it is, November 5th or whatever. 10:04, 10:04, 10:04, it's drilled into your head. 10:04 is an occult reference to not necessarily the time, but the date of October 4th. 10:04, October 4th, in the Gregorian solar calendar, on October 4th, there are exactly 88 days left to the year. This is why the time machine is activated, you know, at 10:04 with 88. It's a longer story, but I talk about it much more in the First Cinema book. So if you're interested in The Exorcist and Back to the Future, check out the First Cinema book.
What about the Omen movies? Were they symbolic?
Yes, absolutely. I take on all three of the Omen movies. In the first movie book in Cinema Symbolism, you have the birth and rise of the Antichrist. These are movies, and this is another technique that movie makers play around with, is the weather. In the Omen movies, especially in the second one, when the Antichrist is coming of age, if you pay attention to that, it's never summer or spring when the sun is in exaltation. Of course, the sun is a symbol for Jesus, the resurrected sun, light, life. You're dealing with Neoplatonic imagery. In the second Antichrist movie, or the second Omen movie, if you pay attention to that, it is perpetually flipping between winter and fall, which is the death of the sun when the sun is in decay. In the third Omen movie, this is when Jesus comes back and defeats the Antichrist. The date of the resurrection of the sun, or the second coming, is at the vernal equinox when the sun is resurrected from the tomb of winter. Believe it or not, the third Omen movie was actually released on the vernal equinox of 1981, which is, again, the resurrection of the sun, the Easter celebration, the return of Jesus, the death of darkness, the death of the Antichrist. Yes, there's a lot of imagery. I'm going through this a mile a minute just because of time. But yeah, there's a ton going on in the Omen movies. They're great films anyway.
Arne in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Arne. Go ahead.
Good morning. Hey, I got a question. One of my favorite gems that isn't really considered much with symbolism is Norm Jewison's Rollerball. Are you familiar with it? 1975.
I'm somewhat, but again, it's one of those movies I haven't watched it in such a long time that I wouldn't want to comment on it symbolically. But if you want to tell me what you think you saw, I'd be interested to hear.
Oh, yeah, it's great. You have this messianic figure named Jonathan, and he's the athlete type, and he kind of goes up against the globalists or the world's elite. And there's just a lot of that confrontation in it. Of course, the globalists, they know what's best for him and what's best for everybody, and they take care of everybody. But at the same time, you have to stay in line and do what you're told. It's really fascinating.
1975 movie, I think, Rollerball. It was about the corporate controlled future.
Yeah, it sounds like you got a good grip on it. I'll have to check it out. Sounds fascinating. Sounds like you've really done a good job analyzing it.
They're everywhere. Robert, as the clock ticks here, give us your website, would you, sir?
Yes, sir. Thank you, George, for having me on Coast to Coast AM. I thought the show was terrific. I really appreciate you having me on. My website, I know you linked it up on Coast to Coast. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV. My website is just that. It's www.robertwsullivan.com, the letter I, the letter V for the fourth, robertwsullivaniv.com. Links to buy the books, links to my social media, events and appearances, very easy to navigate, www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
You did a marvelous job on the program, Robert. I want to congratulate and thank you for that.
No, well, thank you, George, for having me on. I thought it was a great show. Great questions, as always. Always like hearing from the callers. I really appreciate you having me on, and anytime you want to have me back, we'll do it again sometime.
You've got an open book here, my friend.
Well, thank you, George, and again, just the show was terrific, and again, I just, you know, really want to thank you for having me on. It's very greatly appreciated.
The name of the book, Cinema Symbolism 2, and all the information linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. Tomorrow on Coast to Coast, Marianne Winkowski joins us, ghost hunting, followed by those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.